This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books. Chapter 15. Mitchell avoided the freeway and drove along US 1 for a few miles. Although it was much slower with the traffic lights, he had more potential exits if he thought he was being followed. He'd seen how the police set up roadblocks on exits and parked police cars with spotters on overpasses when they wanted to stop somebody on I-95. Once they spotted you there, they could close down on you wherever they needed to pin you down. Game over. At least on US-1, he had a sliver of a chance of losing a police car if they decided to follow him. Or at least he hoped so. When he began to get nervous about staying on the same road for too long, he decided to drive a few miles to the west, catch up with State Road 7. Waiting to make the turn, he saw a helicopter flying by, low overhead. His knuckles clenched the wheel until he saw it was a medevac chopper. He relaxed. When he saw it headed toward the mall, he felt anxious again. He hadn't seen as many ambulances racing toward the mall, which he took as a good sign, until he realized that they might have run out of them. In the distance, he could see another helicopter. The scale of what had just happened was starting to build. Mitchell looked at the radio in the car, but was too terrified to turn it on to his station. He'd have to find out what was going on in the rest of the world, but not at that moment, especially when he was out in the open with a stolen car, already panicked. He had no idea where to go. He couldn't drive forever. He needed a safe place. There wasn't a chance in hell he'd try calling one of his friends. From reading the police bulletins on the fax, he knew the two fastest ways to get caught were to get reported to the police when you scared somebody, or to have a scared friend report you when you went to them for help. Besides, he realized he didn't have any friends that he trusted enough to count on. He knew calling his family was out of the question. The last thing he needed was to send his mother or sister into a panic. They both lived in California. Wouldn't be much help anyway. He hadn't talked to them in weeks. He could deal with them later. Going back to his apartment was out. That'd be the first place the police would come looking. What if he barricaded himself in there? He shook his head. The SWAT team or whoever they sent after him could be in there in seconds, and then he didn't want to think about that part. He knew he'd have to turn himself in at some point. There was no way he could make it for as long as a fugitive. But in order for him to surrender, he needed to be sure that whoever arrested him wasn't going to tear him to shreds. To be sure of that, he had to know why people were attacking him. Was it some kind of conspiracy? Was it a weird psychological thing? Had he become such a loser that people were turning on him like a wolf pack on a wounded dog? Worry about where to go next, he reminded himself. Nothing came to mind, so he tried to break down what he needed. It had to be devoid of people. He had to be able to hide the car. He had to have an exit. Finding an out-of-the-way motel was useless unless he could check in without the clerk murdering him. He also knew he couldn't barge into someone's house and hold them hostage. Besides the moral problem of that, he couldn't imagine how he would restrain said person if every moment they were focused on killing him. What about an abandoned house? South Florida was filled with empty houses that were either for sale or foreclosed by the bank. He'd have to break inside, but from there he could open the garage door and park the car. That reminded him of something. He thought for a moment, of course. When Rachel had kicked him out, one of the station interns had told him his grandparents were looking for someone to rent their house. Mitchell had even gone so far as to look at it before deciding it was too far. He still knew the code for the door. It was 40 minutes from where he was, and not too far from the two main highways. It was also two cities over and in the next county. didn't know how much that would help him evade the police, but it had to at least buy him some time. It was a quiet neighborhood where most of the houses were owned by people who lived that estate. Mitchell remembered that almost half the houses had for sale signs. That meant he was less likely to be confronted by neighbors. He knew staying there wasn't the best idea, but for the moment it was his only idea. Mitchell tried to remember how to get there. Even if just for the night, he could hide out, he would have some time to at least plan on what to do next, and hopefully figure out what the hell was wrong with him. Mitchell saw the sign that said Sunny Acres and pulled into the community. It was a planned development from the 1970s, where all the streets were laid out in a grid. Palm trees and flat lawns and uniform rectangles lined the streets. There was a community center and a pool toward the middle. Single-story houses were built from three basic designs and painted from a limited color palette. They all looked the same to Mitchell. Only the random rust stains from the sprinklers differentiated them. He couldn't remember which one was the right one. The last thing he wanted to do was barge in on an unoccupied house. He drove down one road, then up another. There were cars parked sporadically in different driveways. It seemed like there were even more for sale signs than the last time. One house looked vaguely familiar. He pulled into the driveway and tried to figure out what to do next. If he knocked on the door and someone answered, that could be messy. His best bet was to knock and then run back to the car and wait to see if someone answered. It was a coward's plan, and he knew it. It was all he had. Mitchell turned off the car and walked up to the walkway of the house. It looked very familiar. He got to the door and looked at the keypad. He decided just to try the code and open the door and look. He knew he could run back to the car if he heard anyone. Fortunately, his mind didn't blank like it did with the ATM card. Keyed in the code, the door unlocked, and from behind, he heard a car pass. Mitchell almost pissed himself. The car kept driving. Mitchell relaxed and looked inside the house. It was completely empty. He expected that, but wanted to be certain. He shouted, "Hello?" His voice echoed through the house. He looked back at the car in the driveway. The sooner he hit it, the better. He stepped into the house and walked through the barren kitchen and into the garage. He fumbled for the switch that opened the door. Mitchell remembered the intern, Mike, telling him that his grandparents had kept power to the house so their air conditioning would keep the moisture low. Apparently, other people didn't do that with their empty property and caused mold and other damage. Mitchell was glad he didn't have to figure out how to open the door by hand. He pulled the car inside the garage and lowered it. Reasonably certain that no one had seen him, he felt safe for the moment. But for how long? They cast a wide enough net. Would they find him there? His name wasn't attached to the house, not directly at least. Mitchell walked back to the house and peered through the front blinds and looked down the street. What next? Chapter 16. The entire mall was essentially a crime scene. A narrow path had to be cordoned off with yellow tape to show people where they could and couldn't walk. To Rios, it felt like the line through a haunted house. Only this one was filled with real bodies and stretched the length of a shopping mall. They followed the path to the front of the food court. Tables and chairs were flipped over. Spilled drink cups covered the floor, mixing with food and puddles of blood. Rios could spot two places where the firefighters had to put out grease fires on unattended grills. Brooks motioned for them to follow him. He pointed to the other entrance to the food court.
That's where it looks like everyone came through.
Bloody footprints now led away from the narrow corridor between the coffee shop and the cookie store. Overturned chairs and tables were shoved to the side. Some, from the looks of it, pushed aside by first responders trying to make a path. Others, from the trail of blood by the mob of people rushing through here. Rios could make out three outlines of bodies on the ground. Blood was so thick, someone had to lay down floor mats so paramedics and firefighters didn't track it into the mall and leave their own layer of bloody footprints.
We think this is where it started. This was some kind of disruption, and everyone came out of the food court and into the atrium.
A disruption? Said Simmons.
Do we have any idea what kind of disruption would cause this kind of panic? She looked at one of the restaurants that had scorch marks where firefighters put out a small fire. Was it over that? Brooke shook his head.
I don't think so. We think small fires happened after the fact. We won't know until we get a look at the security cameras.
He pointed down the mall.
After they left the atrium, they went down that way. Shit.
To Rios, it looked like something out of National Geographic. The bloody footprints marked a path straight down the mall, tracing out a path of destruction. There were more overturned kiosks, scattered shoes and clothes. Planters were knocked over, leaving piles of dirt and palm trees in the middle of the floor. Pieces of broken window glass were shattered around, and there were bodies under sheets. Lots of bodies. The bodies seemed to be clustered near choke points in places where people had to run into obstacles or been too slow and got overrun by the crowd. Rios tried to imagine what could cause that kind of panic. He looked over at Simmons. She just shook her head. They followed the path down the mall. Since most of the destruction was on the right side, the path stayed mainly on the left side of that wing. Forensic techs were scattered around taking photographs. Others were putting down numbered markers and gathering blood samples. Rios looked into the beachwear shop on their left. Several clothes racks were overturned. He looked across the way into a jean shop and saw more overturned clothes racks leading from the back of the store. He pointed it out to Simmons. Was there anyone on this side of the mall who didn't join the crowd? She asked Brooks.
When I first came here, I didn't see anyone.
He looked at the overturned racks.
Sure looks like they ran out of here in a hurry. We found three babies still in strollers. Their mothers had just left them.
You had mothers abandoning children? As a father, Rios couldn't understand that.
I could see one, maybe, but three?
Brooks pointed to the covered bodies and the tracks of blood.
It's a good thing they did. I can't see a stroller surviving that.
Rios shuddered. Bodies under sheets were one thing. The thought of crushed infants unsettled him to the core. They kept walking. There were more bloody footprints and covered bodies at bottlenecks. Rios and Simmons noticed more knocked over racks and spilled clothes inside the stores beyond the reach of the crowd. Up ahead, they could see the department store everyone had run into. Displays were smashed to pieces along the front. Makeup racks and jewelry cabinets were trampled underfoot. The perfume counter that faced the front of the mall was half caved in. Broken shards of glass stood out at wicked angles. He saw blood splattered over a white dress that looked like one his wife had. Rios felt his mouth go dry when he saw what looked like a decapitated body. He was about to speak up when he realized it was just a mannequin. Nearby, there were two other mannequins that had almost been flattened. They entered the department store. The entire right side looked like a hurricane had gone through there. Counters were smashed. Piles of clothing lay in heaps. Entire departments were leveled. And everywhere were footprints and trails of blood. Brooks took the long way through the relatively unscathed men's section. Rios wondered why that side was spared and the other wasn't. Was a panic crowd as random as a tornado that destroyed two houses but left the one in the middle? Hopefully the security footage would have some answers.
This is where it gets pretty ugly, said Brooks.
Now it gets ugly? Thought Rios. What had they just been looking at? Brooks took a deep breath and pointed toward the escalators.
They all came in over there and tried to go up the down escalator.
Brooks took another breath.
I have no idea why, but 300 people tried to go up there at once. People fell. Then more people fell on top of them. It got worse from there. They tripped on the up escalator, too. It's almost as bad.
The escalator looked like a chute from a slaughterhouse. Dozens of bodies were laid out near a row along the aisle. Jackets and dresses taken down off the racks were used to cover the heads. Brooks looked down near the ground. I was nearby when the call came in. I was one of the first ones here. We had to pull the bodies apart as quickly as we could. There were people suffocating under them. We found some survivors, and then his voice cracked. He trailed off. The blood drained from Rios's cheeks. For the first time, he noticed that Brooks was still in shock. He hadn't realized how soon after the scene he had gotten there. As a detective, he'd become used to arriving after the body count had tallied and not being someone responsible for trying to keep it from climbing. Rios looked over and lined up the bodies. He couldn't imagine what it was like to arrive when they were piled on top of each other with people screaming while trying to claw their way from underneath. Just the thought of it made him want to gasp for air. Ever the professional, Brooks continued.
There's a stairwell at the far end.
They've cleared the bodies and the wounded from there. There was a much smaller number of people than here, but not a pretty sight. We're still trying to sort out the storage room at that end. He looked at Simmons and Rios for an answer. There were over 100 people trapped in a room smaller than my bathroom. He looked at the escalator and shook his head. Simmons spoke up.
I can understand panic. I can understand people following the pack. But why did everyone try to go up?
She pointed to the far end of the store, where light was pouring in from two propped open doors.
We're on the ground floor. Who goes up unless there's a fire?
Brooks shrugged.
I guess they do if they're chasing something.
He led them to an elevator. The doors opened and two paramedics came rushing out, pushing a stretcher with a middle-aged woman whose head was covered in bloody bandages. The second level was filled with people too hurt to be moved just yet, and those with lighter injuries that could wait for medical treatment. Paramedics were using the mattresses in the bedding department to hold all the people. Rios looked around the floor. He counted over 100 people in various states of injury, ranging from claw marks to sprains, what looked like broken arms and legs. Most of them were sitting or laying by themselves as medical workers moved around from person to person, trying to figure out who needed the most help. The fire department captain called over to them.
Over there.
He pointed to a cluster of mattresses where people were laying on them with untreated wounds. Rios remembered he was still holding his first aid kit. He followed Simmons as she ran to help the people that the captain had signaled to. Until they had some answers, it felt good for him to be able to do something besides being a ghoulish spectator.
Chapter 17. Mitchell tore off his ruined shirt and threw it into a corner. He looked at his reflection in the master bathroom mirror.
What's wrong with me?
He asked as if he expected his reversed image to have the answer.
On one side, the right-handed, frightened and confused version. On the other, the left-handed, confident one who knew what to do.
The sight of his own image only added to his sense of despair. There were claw marks on his chest and back. He had bruises he had no idea how he got. His hair was a sweaty mess of brown. He looked exactly like how people look in their mugshot photos. Was this how people look after they were apprehended? Or was falling apart so much what made them easy to spot and capture?
Mitchell turned the faucet and thanked Mike's grandparents for not discontinuing the water. Splashed cold water on his face and smoothed back his hair. For a moment, he didn't feel quite like the state of constant panic he'd felt before. He splashed more water on his face, then caught his first unhurried breath. He turned the faucet off, then looked back into the mirror. His reflection was changed. He felt different. With his hair slicked back and no longer out of control, the effect the water had relaxing the tension in his face and calming his burning cheeks, he didn't look like the man in the middle of a panic attack. He placed his palms on either side of the counter and brought his face in close to the mirror. The face he saw was more composed, less apprehensive. It was the face of someone who could figure out what to do next and manage whatever the world threw at him. He was looking at Mitch, at Mitchell, Mad Mitch, the man in control. Part of it, he knew, was the trick of the sunlight coming through the window, giving his cheekbones and jaw a more masculine look.
but he also knew that somewhere deep inside of him was someone who wanted to survive. He'd seen horrific things that day. Even though a part of him just wanted to fall down and let the nightmare roll over him and bring everything to a close, something told him to keep running. Something told him that his life was worth fighting for. Fighting for. He repeated those words in his head. Yes, he decided. He would fight to survive. He'd never intentionally hurt someone. But if they got in his way, he'd have to go through them. Whatever guilt he was feeling, he could deal with later, when it was time to surrender. He would do it only when he knew he was safe. Until then, he had to protect everything he could protect himself. What the fuck? He said to his reflection. What the fuck? Mitch replied. In broadcasting school, he'd learned the quickest way to feel confident was to assume the posture of someone who looked confident. Even when you were alone, he turned around and hopped up and sat on the counter. For a moment, he would try to think of a reason why certain people were trying to kill him. If the girl by the side of the road hadn't attacked him, he would have thought that something happened to him at the radio station. But she had. If he'd been attacked by Rookman or Bonnie or the old man at the gas station, things would make more sense. Why not them, but everyone else? Couldn't be proximity. He was much closer to most of them than anyone else. Mitchell looked at his reflection in the medicine cabinet mirror, hoping for the more confident version of himself to give him an answer. He did. Rookman. Bonnie and the gas station dude were behind glass, dumbass, said Mitch. Fuck. Mitch thought back over the last 2 weeks since he'd been sick. When was the last time he'd actually been face-to-face with anyone that wasn't behind glass or on a Skype screen? He hadn't. What was the most significant thing that happened between the time when people just ignored him and when they wanted to murder him on sight? Getting sick. What did he come down with? Reverse rabies? Could there even be such a thing? It was stupid. But it made the most sense for the time being. It gave him something to think around. Rather than thinking it was something so far beyond his understanding or involving a cosmic-level conspiracy, the hypothesis that something he could deal with on a rational level soothed him. Seeing him wasn't what made people want to kill him. It was something in the air. Something he gave off. Either a scent or something else, like a fast-acting virus. Maybe it was like the pheromones bees gave off when it was time to attack. Did getting sick mess with his pheromones and tell people to kill him? Didn't matter for the moment. Knowing that it was the scent or something else that he gave off allowed him to focus on the problem. The key to his immediate survival was going to be avoiding having people smell him or breathe the air near him. Handing out gas masks or finding a spacesuit weren't practical solutions. Until the authorities understood what was going on, he had to avoid them as well. Mitchell hopped off the counter and walked into the house, checking the windows and doors again. Everything was locked down. Not that it mattered if the police surrounded the house. They'd have no trouble getting inside. Mitch walked back into the bathroom, splashed some water under his arm and onto his chest. Dried off using toilet paper. No time for a shower. Just wanted to get some of the sweat and smell of fear off him. He looked back at the reflection. What now? Find out what's going on and move to someplace else. He pulled out his iPhone. It was still turned off. Did they locate it when he powered it on? He knew they could trace phone calls, but what about just the phone? There was a Find My Phone function that used GPS and Wi-Fi spots to find iPods and iPads. All he had to do was log into his Mobile Me account and click a button to see where his device was. Fuck! His iPad! Mitchell put his phone back in his pocket and ran to his backpack. He pulled out his iPad and pressed the home button. It was on. He quickly powered it down. He knew the odds were against them having got such a search warrant and accessed his account to trace him. There was that small chance. He could take a risk, or he could assume the safe house was blown. Scared Mitchell wanted to stay there, or better yet, go hide in the attic. The Mitch he caught a glimpse of in the mirror knew it was a bad idea to stay. The more he tried to guess the risk on things like that, the more likely he was to put himself in harm's way. Something Mitchell had put at the back of his mind finally made its way forward. He got a look at the time. For some reason, he thought it was almost nightfall. It was only 1 p.m. He'd left the mall just over an hour ago. He'd left his car and that mess at Rachel's less than 20 minutes before he got to the mall. He had been on the run for less than 2 hours. All hell was going to break loose very soon, and a lot of angry people were going to be looking for him. However, he still had time to get more distance. He had time to find out what the rest of the world was saying. Mitchell shoved his iPad back in his backpack, and he sat down with his back against the front door so he could listen to the street outside while keeping his eye on the backyard through the sliding glass doors. He pulled out an analog radio he kept tuned to the radio station and turned it on.
This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books.